But by the time we've reached this moment of the death of God, we already have a strange change in the discourse. What new games, new festivals, what could be invented now to make up for what has already been destroyed? What myths could we construct ourselves? What games? What holy festivals? What interesting books, fascinating arguments, and new ways to live, other than the pathetic, tragic, stupid, banal array of ordinary, everyday, bourgeois, stinking life? Surely, we can do better than that.
Hello and welcome to the 140th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. The guest this week is Marxist YouTube star and pianist Brendan Cooney, and we discuss real abstractions, fetishes, the Greek economic crisis, and the superpowers of Karl Marx. It's Tuesday, April 17th, 2012, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast. Diet Soap has been on a temporary hiatus as I struggled to revise a novel as quickly as possible, but we return this week despite the fact that I haven't quite finished yet. I've been up to my eyeballs in Dreams, Christopher Robin Milne, Cats That Turn Into Toys, and The Strikes of May 1968. And yet the podcast continues. I want to thank all of the subscribers to the podcast who are participating in the Diet Soap Philosophy Writers Workshop and urge you to either subscribe or donate yourself. I currently have 12 copies left of my book, Wave of Mutilation, and even more copies of my surrealist memoir on urban foraging entitled Pick Your Battle. So subscribing or donating $6 or more entitles you to a copy of one of those books, and you can find the PayPal buttons on the DietSoap.Podomatic.com webpage. I should point out that this week marks the third year for the Diet Soap podcast. The very first episode was produced on April 16th, 2009, and it is also the last week that Diet Soap will feature a Titanic factoid. Sunday was the 100-year anniversary of the sinking, and Miriam has decided to commemorate April 15th, 1912, with a sinking of the factoid. So this week we say goodbye to the Titanic factoid, but I look forward to seeing what Miriam comes up with next, and she promises that she will continue to contribute. Right now you're listening to Song of Autumn, which was probably the last song performed on the RMS Titanic of the White Star Line. Ah, Titanic, what majesty, what tragedy. In just a moment, you'll be listening to Brendan Cooney and I discuss the reality of economic abstractions. Well, maybe we should start. I can tell you what I'm running up against. There's a particular forum. The people who are talking to each other through Facebook are all either anarchists or some kind of Marxist. Some of them are coming from a background having been involved in different trot groups. Nobody is actually still in a sectarian group, as far as I can tell.
Did you ever see it was a long time ago in the early days of the internet. On the DSA website, the Democratic Socialists of America website, they had a map of the loony left. You can still find it sometimes if you Google, if you spend long enough on. I wish I still had the picture. It was amazing. This branching, like some sort of fractal. It was like a sort of this flowchart of all the different groups, how they split from each other. They were just like, you know, dozens and dozens of groups all branching from a couple early Trotskyist groups. And then they would have the numbers, the amount of numbers of members. Anyway, it's a great, if I find the image, I'll send it to you. It's a great.
I'd love to see that. Well, there is certainly, even though no one is involved in a sectarian group that I know of on in this forum online, I can see the dynamic of at work in our discussions. I mean, if we were more cohesive, we would have split already, you know.
Right. Go ahead.
No. Well, okay. Well, I just but the thing that I bump my head up against the wall about over and over again is whether or not we can really look to, say, Marx's value theory or just the economic realm at all as determinative. In other words, like originally I sent you a bunch of questions about Greece, and it was coming out of my discussions online. Mm-hmm. A lot of people wanted to say, look, the politicians in Europe, their hands really aren't tied. If they wanted to end the austerity program, you know, provide for the people and solve the problem, they could. They would simply have to print money, you know, let Greece default and let them print their own money. And then they, you know, then it would start to fix itself. This is all politics, is what they're saying. It's an attack on the working class.
Right.
And I want to say, well, look, there are limits to what the politicians can do because of economic realities. And essentially, you know, maybe I'm mischaracterizing their argument, but it seems to me that they will just kind of repeatedly say, look, there really is no economic realm. It's all politics. These things aren't determined. Marx was making a mistake in his focus on economics. And it's what's funny is that some Marxists won't disagree strongly enough with that, or will even agree with that in different contexts. So I wanted to ask you that question. Was how do you run up against that kind of thinking?
What you're saying about Greece and people's talks about Greece reminds me of what people said about the bailout of the banks in the U.S. a couple years ago, and what people have been saying about neoliberalism for a long time, treating these things as purely political projects. I mean, David Harvey, in his book on neoliberalism, calls neoliberalism a political project. Andrew Kleinman's book on the crisis does something different. He argues that most of the institutional features that we associate with neoliberalism were direct responses to the crisis of the 70s. And the sort of political personalities and ideas that we consider neoliberal actually arrived later on the historical time. You know, they come with in the early 80s with Thatcher and Reagan. But the actual sort of changes in flows of capital between countries, the liberation of markets and the turn to finance capital and different sort of policy things were all things that were sort of direct responses to the needs of the crisis of the 70s. And much of the neoliberal period can be seen as a result of that crisis, as a response to that crisis. There was the hand. Now, of course, like if those are the policy responses that capital is necessitating, then certain types of people, certain types of ideas will. If those are the sort of policy options that capital is prescribing, then those ideas will be embodied in certain types of people and certain types of ideas. Just like in the coming out of the Great Depression, it was Keynesianism, ideas of Keynesians that sort of embodied those responses to the crisis.
I understand what you're saying. I just know that if I were to simply say that in this online forum, I get a lot of pushback. What you and I both basically believe is that the economic realm determines the political responses that you get.
Choices.
Yeah.
People don't have choices.
It sets the context that you can make choices in. It doesn't necessarily say that there are – it doesn't mean that – it doesn't determine which choice you make.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that history is like written already or that everything is determined or that like Marx could have predicted the Greek, you know, crisis or something. That's not a sort of like predictive determination. it's a limiting.
Right. It's like, for instance, if I'm taking a multiple choice test, it isn't determined ahead of time which bubble I'm going to fill in, but I'm going to either have to fill in one of the bubbles or write in an answer and see what happens, right? I mean, my options are limited or determined by the form of the test.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with the Greek, right? I mean, you know, I don't want to go into the Greek thing with a lot of detail or I'm going to get myself in trouble. But I mean, what's going on in Europe seems to be this thing where the choices that are in front of people are all so bad and there are just so few choices that the only thing that seems possible to do is just to sort of kick the can down the road as far as they possibly can and to hope that you can sort of push it off in a couple countries. But it just seems like the entire political structure of the euro is not going to be capable to absorb this crisis, that they're not going to come up with solutions that really work. There's the whole issue of the bank bailouts in the U.S., right? Because people said this were just purely political handouts that Bush was giving to his cronies and the banks. But if there hadn't been the bailout, capitalism would have fallen apart. That was an incredibly crucial move, bailing out those banks. And a lot of people on the left weren't able to acknowledge that. Because we were in this mindset of wanting to see these things as purely political issues and not. I mean, the real stupidity of it is when you listen to the promises that presidential candidates make and they're, you know, my plan will do this and this and get this many jobs. And it's just ridiculous. It's just pure. They're just making shit up off the top of their head. There's no substance to it at all. I mean, there's no possible way a politician is going to legislate their way out of an economic crisis. There's just no way. All they can do is let it happen and decide how fast it's going to happen. I mean, maybe they can have control over that much.
Well, on the one hand, we can't legislate our way out of an economic crisis. On the other hand, we can bail out the banks. I mean, there is legislation that you can put in place that will have dramatic economic consequences. You can pass laws that regulate, say, the financial sector, or you can put together a stimulus package. These are all political actions that can have an impact on the economic, right?
The amazing thing is how little any of those things seem to really matter, how like pathetic the effect they have is. I mean, we did this enormous, we're still finding out how much money was thrown into the bailing out the banks. And that worked. It like kept capitalism from going to the crisis from like falling apart on that week, on that day. Mm-hmm. But it didn't, like, you know, stop us from going into a recession, and it's not going to stop us from staying in this sort of stagnant state for a long time.
We can't really understand anything in isolation. We only really understand things by comparing them to something else. If we are to understand what is truly distinctive about a capitalist crisis, we need to compare capitalism to something outside of itself. In order to make the most striking comparison, here we will use the example of a primitive hunter-gatherer society. The economic life of these early societies was extremely simple because there was no differentiation of work activities. Labor was a collective effort in which everyone participated to the best of their ability. The products of that labor were shared amongst the community according to need. The economic structure of these early primitive gatherer societies was a large, undifferentiated whole. There was no possibility of internal economic crisis because there were no internal parts that could be in conflict with each other or get out of sync. Economic crisis, then, was external. Drought, cold, fire, disease, predators. The brutal forces of nature had their way with early man. It was this opposition between man and nature that defined life for early man. Capitalism could be seen as the polar opposite of this. Our vast productive abilities have enabled us, for the most part, to be free of this polar opposition with the natural world. By producing a social surplus, we can store up goods to feed us in times of drought, to shelter us from the ravages of storm and cold. This tremendous productive ability is accompanied by a tremendous differentiation of economic activity into separate parts, millions of different productive units, workers, companies, banks, governments, all coordinated through capitalist markets. When crisis hits a capitalist society, it is not because of some external shock, but because something has gone awry internally. The mechanism by which all these different labors are coordinated has broken down. Crisis in a capitalist society is not a matter of man versus nature, but of man versus himself. You might even say the external conflict has been internalized. How are all the different productive activities of a capitalist society coordinated? Rather than sharing in one collective laboring effort, like in the hunter-gatherer society, capitalist production is separated into millions of separate labor processes, all coordinated through the exchange of commodities. By exchanging commodities in the marketplace, the labor of tomato pickers, car makers, hairstylists, and coal miners is all coordinated. The private labors of these individual labor processes each make up just one small part of the total labor process of society. Their labors are represented in the form of commodities. What at first glance appears to be just physical objects exchanging with one another is actually a complicated process whereby the various components of a social labor process are brought together. Karl Marx remarked about this process that material relations between people become social relations between things. That is, commodities become representations of these tiny parts of the collective social labor process.
If we talk about this on the level of recent history and real politics and real activity, it's easy, I think, to lose sight of the theoretical disagreement or the abstract disagreement that's behind the real disagreement. I mean,
sure.
Like no one in my forum is thinking that capitalism is healthy right now, and everyone recognizes that this is a systemic crisis on some level or another. There's still this resistance to taking a look at the economic realm as something that that you can't push around beyond a certain point, that has its own limits built in. And it has to do with some pretty abstract questions. Like, I sent you a question that this is it. I'm just going to read it to you. It says, how is it that a social relationship embodied in a commodity relationship can be outside of the political control of the people who acted out by producing commodities? Because ultimately, the commodity itself doesn't have any real power of its own. So we've created this relationship through the commodity, but we don't – somehow it's gotten beyond us. And I think that seems paradoxical and absurd to people. It's hard to fathom that something that isn't a natural fact but is socially produced – is somehow still beyond the control of our conscious social actions or political actions.
I think that's a great place to start because, I mean, really everything has to do with the fetish character of the commodity. And fetishism is one of those things that it's so tricky to talk about because, it, like you said, it's one of these things that starts to sort of burst at the limits of what your brain can hold at the same time. You start to feel the fog forming around the corners of your brain, and you're trying to like, kind of like trying to shake a hangover out of your head or something. You're just like, wah! I merge articulately from my brain. Ideas make sense to me. Why is this? Oh, I keep going in circles here. You know, unfortunately, sometimes people don't understand the central place that the fetish argument has in Marx's work. They see it as just an argument about sort of ideology. Or that fetishized ideas are ideas you can just get rid of with correct theory. One of the first points Marx makes is that it doesn't matter how you think and it doesn't matter how well you understand the fetish nature of commodities. It's still there. It's inscribed in the basic nature of the construction of a capitalist society. One of the things that Marx does that I think makes him so unique as a thinker is that Marx, when he attacks his opponents, he doesn't try to prove that they're wrong. He tries to explain where their ideas come from. And often he's trying to explain why they don't understand why they're right. So Adam Smith and the labor theory of value. Marx agrees with Adam Smith that labor is the content of value. He might disagree with Adam Smith on some particulars of his analysis, and he missed this category and that category, but the main critique is that he agrees with Adam Smith, but he says Adam Smith doesn't understand why he's right. Adam Smith thinks that this is a universal category, that labor has always produced value, and he wants to relate it very much to just a use value. Labor creates these things, and the more it creates, the more value is, blah, blah, blah. And Marx says, no, only in a particular type of society does this value emerge from the labor process. And we must understand this very specific conjuncture of social relations, this very specific organization with all these different institutional and social features that allow value relations to emerge. And then he goes about trying to explain, you know, why this concept of value, labor creating value, is correct. What sort of society does this emerge in?
While I'm reading Marx's Capital and discussing it online, I'm getting a lot of pushback. And one thing that I'm told is that Marx is only joking. That is, he was writing a parody of Adam Smith, showing that even if you took Smith totally seriously, his ideas were riven with contradictions. And the point is that Marx doesn't really believe in the models he's using in Capital, but just showing them up to be false or contradictory. So how do you approach the question of what to take seriously in Marx,
right,
and what to treat as a joke?
Well, first of all, really, you should read Capital with as open a mind as you possibly can, and try not to take other people's interpretations too seriously until you've had the evidence before your eyes. That being said, the structure of Capital is pretty amazing as a book, and I'm not going to claim that I can understand it as well as some people can. You know, Marx never writes about dialectics. He never tells us how he considers dialectics. We know he's a student of Hegel, and we know that he also has a critique of Hegel, but we don't know exactly what that means for his method. What we know is from reading his work and seeing the method at work that he's using in Capital and in the Grundrisse. What's interesting is that we start with an extremely abstract picture of the commodity, and we're dealing with it in these very abstract terms. Oh, it's a use value and a value, and we're looking at it in very sort of empirically at first, and then we're looking at it and finding this sort of transcendental substance of value that lies underneath of it. And over the course of the book, these very abstract pictures of value take on more and more concrete substance. They're imbued with a little more and more social meaning, until by the end of the book, we see that this commodity, this abstractness that we think of as value, is actually this sort of socially determined thing that's as a result of a certain type of society with certain features like wage labor, class, capital. And by the very end of the book, we see that it's also about a result of a very historical process of primitive accumulation that involved state and private property. And so it's important to sort of keep that in mind, that no matter, people characterize this process in Capital different ways, but no matter how you characterize it, there is this process going on of this picture you have of value being expanded, and what value means taking on more and more meaning and becoming more determined and more specific the more we read in the book. And that method is very important for that method is very important for critiquing capital because of this phenomenon of fetishism, where things do not appear as they are all the time, and the social nature of things is not apparent in the world of appearances, and we have to sort of some people talk about piercing through the world of appearances to the essence behind it, but I think it's more than that. It's about uncovering all these multiple layers of social determination that are behind the sort of fetishized exterior world that we see in our day-to-day lives.
This gets back to the question about whether or not what we're dealing with is a political problem or an economic problem. When you say that the fetish kind of obscures the social nature of our relationships, and that Marx is kind of uncovering the social nature of our relationships, but then at the same time you say he starts with an abstraction and then it gets and moves towards the concrete. It's actually easy for me to be a little confused about what you mean, because on the one hand, it would seem like what you want to do is just push past the abstraction and get to the concrete. And that's the temptation for people who want to say that what we're dealing with is a political problem. What they're wanting to say is, look, this is a problem of our social relationships. But what they then do is say, and our social relationships are just a matter of political will.
Right.
Marx turns it around. It's like he starts with something really abstract and theoretical, and then builds up to a point where we can see our social relationships laying on top of this foundation of the abstract. But that's really counterintuitive, because this abstraction is what he wants to try to get rid of. So if we rely on this abstraction to even have social relationships, how can we possibly get rid of it? Can't we? Don't we have to go to pure, real social relationships shouldn't that be our first move?
Well, the issue is that our social relationships are abstract already in a capitalist society. So Marx is mirroring the existing real abstractions in society. He's not making just a philosophical abstraction, because a philosophical abstraction can be somewhat arbitrary. You can decide what you want to abstract out from the totality of society and make your fundamental categories and decide how to define them. But Marx is saying this is what society does. Society has this abstraction called value. This is something that my next video is dealing with. It's in the works, scripts posted online. We are very aware of abstractions. We deal with the abstraction of value all the time, right? Money is value in the abstract. It is just value. It doesn't relate to anything. It could be anything. You could buy anything with money. It's not any concrete use value. It doesn't have any use value to anyone except that what it can buy. And what it can buy is just completely just, it could be anything. And so it's just value in the abstract. This is so this problem of value in the abstract is this phenomenon of value in the abstract is something that exists in our society, and we have to figure out where it comes from, what it means, and what the sort of this we know that so it, money has all the social power. It can make people do all these things. Mm-hmm. I can buy anything I want. I can make anyone do anything I want if I have enough money. And money makes me do things in order to get it. I have to go get a job and work and do all this bullshit in order to get money. So it has the social power, and I don't have the social power as a person. I can go and make people do anything I want without money. No one can make me do anything unless I need some money for it. So money seems to have all the social power, but that doesn't seem to make any sense, because money isn't even social. It's just these pieces of paper or these digits or this plastic credit card in my pocket. It seems to be a nothing. So how do we explain that? There must be some particular organization of society that makes such an abstraction possible. This can't be some universal, money floating in space doesn't have social power. So we have to figure out what the particular organization of society is that allows this abstraction to emerge.
I think one thing we want to do is also just to look at concepts here. I've come to suspect that the very idea of a transitional society is incoherent, and I think it stands in the way of thinking things through clearly. And I think that Hegel's critique of gradualness, the idea of gradualness, is relevant here. Since Lenin, left thinkers have discussed Hegel's critique of gradualness mostly in relationship to revolution versus evolution. But Hegel also says that what applies to coming to be applies equally to ceasing to be. So I think his critique, Hegel's critique, is relevant also to the idea that capitalism ceases to be through a gradual period of transition. Not coherent notion, really. Hegel argues that change is conceived of by people as gradual in order to create a palpable image, in order to make it possible almost to watch the disappearing with one's eyes. Change is thereby supposedly reduced to the easily understood process of mere quantitative decay or of adding on. You seem to see the change right before your eyes, and since you see it gradually happening, you think that there's no explanation needed. Yet the image explains nothing, since what requires explanation is the essential character of the change. That is not gradual. That's a conceptual abrupt change. It's what Hegel calls the abstract transition of an existence into the negation of the existence. Appeals to gradualness evade the need to explain this by assuming the problem away. With the gradual disappearance of something, the non-being or the other which takes its place, Hegel says, is likewise assumed to be already really there but not yet observable. Okay? Not in the sense of being implicitly or ideally contained in the first something, but really there. Okay? Look, it happens gradually. You have the idea it's already there and it just sort of expands. But it's not really there. And it seems to me that, for instance, Tipton and Altman fall prey to this critique. Instead of theorizing the negation of existing capitalism, they're just assuming that it withers away as a socialist economy takes its place. Now, Marx and Engels do talk about the gradual withering away of the state. Okay? But there's a difference, I think, between that and the gradual withering away of capitalism during a transitional period. And it has to do with the difference between the political and the economic that Anne talked about. Political domination is rooted in class antagonisms. Class antagonisms are rooted in turn in the existence of the division of society into classes. And the division of society into classes is rooted in the mode of production. Thus, the withering of the way of the state is intelligible because it's predicated on the revolutionary transformation of the mode of production upon which the existence of the state ultimately rests. Once the mode of production is transformed, society won't be divided into classes, so there won't be class antagonisms, and that eliminates the need for a state in the proper sense of the word state. So the state withers away because of the elimination of the mode of production on which the state rests. Okay? But what sense can we make of the notion that capitalist relations gradually wither away? Capitalism is a mode of production. Upon what does a mode of production ultimately rest, the elimination of which would cause a mode of production to wither away? The notion of a gradual withering away just does not seem intelligible here.
Well, one thing about money is that it's indirect. It's an indirect force. I don't know if this applies to what you're saying, but I recently, well, they're going to increase the fares here and for buses and trains in Portland, and it makes me upset that they're going to do that. So I thought, well, what I'd like to do is get involved with Occupy Portland, or Occupy Wall Street here, and say we should run a campaign to make mass transit absolutely free, fareless, you know, just push the opposite way from where it's going. And I was bringing this idea up to some other friends of mine who I work with and who take the bus regularly. And I got an objection from people who definitely wanted to keep the fares low but were unwilling to see a completely fareless situation, because fares limited the access of buses to the from the underclass, from the criminal element in society. I mean, they didn't say it like that, but they were concerned.
The fares are free. The buses are free. Then just all the bunch of drunk and homeless people will be on the bus all the time.
Right. Oh,
interesting.
Yeah. Homeless people, black people, you know.
That would make buses so much more exciting.
That's true. But
why don't you petition to have free booze on all the buses?
That's a good idea. Only after 5 on the way home. Let's not be ridiculous. And on Sundays all day long, starting with champagne brunches. And this person wasn't being as racist as I made it sound, because he didn't speak in those terms. But there has been incidences of violence in the limited areas that the fair is, that there is no fair in Portland. There's a little range where it's fareless, and there have been more gang-related violence there and drug-related violence in those areas. So he was saying, look, we want a fair to keep people who shouldn't be taking crime at, taking the trains and buses off. And so I said, well, why not just, I mean, put security guards on if you're worried about crime. And that was like, oh, no, that's fascist, you know. That's. So money is standing in, you know, for
right.
Political force.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good example.
It's this abstraction that regulates the world for us and actually does it in a kinder, gentler way, seemingly, than just direct political action tends to.
Right. I mean, look, in feudalism, it was very clear. Your surplus labor was very clear. You worked on your own land, and then you walked over to your landlord's land and worked on his land and made stuff for him. And it was like very clear, the social relationship there. In a capitalist society, it's not clear. No one's like forcing us to, with like, you know, knights and armor, forcing us to give them our surplus labor. Instead, we line up at Manpower Incorporated and beg them to take our surplus labor from us, and we call it freedom. Now, for, you know, a lot of people, including Marx, they looked at that and said, okay, well, there's something very similar going on here. We're still in a class society, and we still have surplus labor being appropriated. But there's also something very different about these two types of exploitation. And one, it's very direct, and one, it's indirect. So what is the nature of this indirect exploitation, this indirect labor? I mean, that's the big category that I think is a really crucial category for understanding capital, the category of indirect labor. Because our labor is not immediately social in a capitalist society. It's only social through the market, and there are several levels of mediation that are happening before our labor becomes social labor. First, is our labor at adequate efficiency to be part of the labor of the firm we work in, right? And then there's modal or mean labor that our firm produces. How does it relate to the rest of the firms in the industry? And that's what socially necessary labor time is. So we're already sort of going through a mediation. The work we're doing in the firm isn't immediately becoming social labor. It's only social labor once the labor of all the industries, I mean all the firms in one industry are sort of compared with each other on the market. And that, of course, is like a long temporal process of buying and selling in the market. And with turnover times of commodities can take a long time. It could be, you know, several months before you even know if your firm is competing productively enough with another firm. And then you have all the different industries competing with each other over selling things to consumers. And so there's that another level of mediation there. So the work we do doesn't actually become social labor until someone has bought the commodities we produce with money. We have our labor has to be turned into profit for the capitalist in order to become social labor. And that's a step we never see. And it goes through all these mediations. So it creates the and this is why, you know, this is why fetishism exists, because labor is indirect. So you don't get to the point where the commodity fetches a price until very much farther down the road. And then it's easy to get the illusion that the value of commodities isn't coming from the social power of labor, but it's coming from other things like the roundaboutness of production, which is the old sort of Austrian excuse for where profit comes from, or that it's coming from the risk capitalists are taking, or all these other different, you know, theories of surplus value that people have had. It's easy for commodities to seem like commodities and money to seem like they have autonomous power and value unto themselves as objects, or that's just something given to them by consumers, because this labor process is an indirect process, and there's all these mediations before our labor becomes social.
Well, but you know what's interesting is that guys like David Harvey, though, aren't making that mistake. It's like they're making the opposite one somehow. They're acting you know what I mean? It's like they're not taking the commodities or money to have some independent power of its own. In fact, they're going all the way to the other extreme and saying it doesn't actually have any power at all. And maybe David Harvey would never say that, but that's the argument I run up against, is that, you know, again, our escape route from this problem is to just override the power of the commodity, just to override the economic realm altogether and go to politics proper, social relations proper, in an unmediated way.
Right. Well, here's what's tricky about it, right, is that in a market society, you don't need the guns to make people do things because the market makes them do things, right? But the guns are still there. So it's one of these like tricky ways you have to wrap your mind around it a certain way. It's one of these things where at first you finally feel like your brain is falling apart trying to figure out how it all fits together. And then once you somehow figure out how to think dialectically the right way, it starts to make sense.
Clearly from Marx, crisis runs to the core of capitalist social relations all the way to value itself. But of course, at this fundamental sort of abstract level of value and commodity production, there's tendencies for crisis to exist, sort of an abstract potential state. When you read the first chapter of Capital for the first time, perhaps, like me, you ask yourself how Marx is talking about this contradiction between the use value and exchange value of a commodity, and you might ask yourself how this could possibly be the sort of thing that could form the basic social antagonisms of our society, where, right, we're expecting Marx to immediately talk about class struggle and crisis, and instead he's talking about a commodity containing this contradiction between use and exchange value, and you wonder how this almost like a very abstract idea could turn into something as big as capitalist crisis. And of course, we don't see that whole picture. For three volumes and thousands of pages and years of reading later, we finally get to see the whole picture.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's Diet Soap podcast. My conversation with Brendan Cooney went on for a good while longer and wandered, so this may be a two-parter. I've currently got at least 5 weeks of interviews in the archive. So in the coming weeks, we'll hear conversations with Paul Shetler on surrealism, with KMO and Olga on zombies, with Ross Wolf on Taylorism or Fordism, with John Mead on the concept of the production of space, and with the bizarro writer Bradley Sands on why he ruined your orgy. The music you heard in this podcast came from Brendan Cooney. It was Cooney's Rhinoceri Trio performing In and Out, you heard, while Andrew Kleinman talked about Hegel's argument against the idea of gradualness. Also, you heard from Brendan's YouTube video on capitalist crisis. And as I said at the outset, this week marks the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. And it also will mark the last Diet Soap Titanic factoid. So while right now you're listening to the overture to the musical Titanic, in just a moment you'll be listening to my lovely wife Miriam with the very last Titanic factoid.
Doug tells me that it has been 3 years since he began the podcast, and along with it, the Titanic factoid. This month, in particular this last Sunday, April the 15th, also marks the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, in case you've missed it. James Cameron's film Titanic has been re-released in 3D, and the Titanic is in the media everywhere. Just going through the grocery store aisle, I saw that the Titanic is the subject for Life magazine, and I actually happened to pick up a copy of the current National Geographic, which has the Titanic on its cover and numerous articles on the subject. I saw in the paper that there was a review for a new young adult book on the Titanic, and these are just a few examples. It's everywhere. This will also be the last Titanic factoid, and I really have enjoyed digging up all the various little tidbits, trying to find new and interesting things to share. It does seem like a nearly inexhaustible subject, but I've done it long enough, and I think I'm going to move on to something else. So what that will be has yet to be determined. If anyone has a suggestion, perhaps cocktail recipes or knitting tips or some other historical event for me to do, feel free to email it to Doug through his website at douglaslane.com, or you can contact him through Facebook or Twitter, and I will consider the possibilities. So on to the Titanic itself. The article I found, articles in National Geographic, were really quite interesting, so I thought that I would share some information I found there, even though you yourself can go pick this up and buy it, and even find a lovely poster, which I plan to hang on the wall, showing sort of a map of the wreck on the ocean floor. Much of these articles focus on how technology, sonar imagery in particular, is making a complete picture of what this final Titanic wreck looks like. The wreck was discovered in 1985 by explorer Robert Ballard and also Jean-Louis Michel. It's deep, deep underwater where no light reaches, crushing pressure, and so it's really hard to reach and hard to get a lot of information about. A number of submersibles have gone down. James Cameron has gone down and has some things even in this magazine to say about it. We're really starting to get a bigger picture of how this crash occurred deep, deep underwater that has been hidden for so long. So I'm going to quote from the article by Hampton Sides.
In every age, mankind attempts to fabricate great works at once magnificent and impossible. On desert sands, from mountains of stone, a pyramid, from flying buttresses alone, a wall of light, a chapel ceiling screaming one man's ecstasy, miracles them all, China's endless wall, Stonehenge, the Parthenon, the Duomo, the aqueducts of Rome. We did not attempt to make with mammoth blocks of stone a giant pyramid, no, not a pyramid, nor Gothic walls that radiate with light. Our task was to dream upon and then create a floating city. Human metropolis, a complete civilization, sleek and fast, at once a poem and the perfection of physical engineering, at once a poem and the perfection of physical engineering. How did they build Titanic near 1,000 feet in? Beyond past endeavor, strong beyond mind.
What is it about the wreck of the RMS Titanic? Why, a century later, do people still lavish so much brain power and technological ingenuity upon this graveyard of metal more than 2 miles beneath the ocean surface? Why, like Pearl Harbor, Ground Zero, and only a few other hallowed disaster zones, does it exert such a magnetic pull on our imagination? For some, the sheer extravagance of Titanic's demise lies at the heart of its attraction. This has always been a story of superlatives, a ship so strong and so grand, sinking in water so cold and so deep. For others, the Titanic's fascination begins and ends with the people on board. It took 2 hours and 40 minutes for the Titanic to sink, just long enough for 2,208 tragic epic performances to unfold, with the ship's lights blazing. One coward is said to have made for the lifeboats dressed in women's clothing, but most people were honorable, many heroic. The captain stayed at the bridge, the band played on, the Marconi wireless radio operators continued sending their distress signals until the very end. The passengers, for the most part, kept to their Edwardian stations. How they lived their final moments is the stuff of universal interest, a dance macabre that never ends. And this is how it is with these historic events. When I first became interested in the Titanic, I think there was something about the sheer size of this ship and the suddenness with which it met its end that was so striking. And then there are the stories of the people on board. You have the absolute wealthiest people, and then the steerage passengers, the people who were immigrating, some of the very poorest people who had managed to save up enough money to get passage to the United States to start a new life. And then there were all the workers on board, the stories of people who didn't quite make it, who were going to be firemen or were going to be stewards, who just barely missed the boat. All of these pieces that are just a part of this story. And after time has gone by, what we have left is the story and all the pieces that we put together for it. The moment itself seems so fleeting. No human bodies were actually found, although you may have seen a Yahoo article showing what almost seems like remains. They found shoes together and clothes that make it clear that a body had lain there. But just the signs of that human touch that makes history come alive. He says, "Of all our discoveries, the most evocative are the relics that suggest the human hands that touched them. In Henry Harper's D-deck cabin, his bowler hat remains in the ruins of his closet, right where he left it. In Edith Russell's cabin on A-deck, the mirror still gleams in her washstand, reflecting back the bot's LED lights instead of Edith's terrified face as she rushed back into the room to get her lucky toy pig before running to board a lifeboat. In another stateroom, a glass decanter and water glass sit, impossibly, still on the washstand. Had the glass been empty, it would have floated out of its holder when the room flooded and been lost. But someone took a drink and left it half full, and there it sits today. In the soundproof Marconi room, the wireless apparatus survives, the knife switches still in the positions left by the young operators, Harold Bride and Jonathan Phillips, revealing that they cut the power when they abandoned their post as the water rushed up the deck outside. We even imaged the transformer they had repaired just the night before the sinking. Acting against guidelines, the two young wireless geeks managed to restore the set to full power, an act that may have saved 712 lives, since without this power, they might not have reached the rescue ship Carpathia with their historic SOS.